attention, please. All the guests on WestJet Flight 926 coming from Toronto, Quebec, have been displaced in the country.
If you want a really good down-to-earth example of the power of innovation, just head to your local airport. Hello, Anthony Fennell here. Welcome to Future Tense. I'm not talking about new aircraft design or automated check-in facilities or any of that stuff. I'm talking about luggage. Specifically, about luggage with tiny casters and an extendable handle. I call them wheelerboards. You might have another name for them, but you know what I mean. And I'm not the only one who thinks they're an impressive development. Economist Jason Murphy is also a bit of a fan.
I mean, innovation can be incredibly unsexy, and that's what people forget. There is a great deal of really economically important innovation that goes on that doesn't really have even anything to do with invention. If you look at where the rubber hits the road, innovation is important when it's adopted broadly, not just when it's invented. And for our economy, one of the most important things we can do is just take ideas that have been invented elsewhere and apply them. That doesn't sound very cool and it doesn't sound very fun, but it's where a lot of the benefits of innovation come from for a small country like Australia.
And there's an understanding there that innovation is often incremental, that it doesn't just happen in one big burst.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm really obsessed with the way suitcases, which had been invented for, you know, trunks and suitcases had been invented for millions of years along with the wheel. And it wasn't until the 1980s that the two concepts were brought together by an American airline pilot, actually, into rolling luggage. And now, of course, everyone in the airport is dragging along their luggage on little wheels. And it goes to show that, yeah, you can make an incremental improvement to a product that's been out there for a very long time and make a big, big difference.
His name is Robert Plath, by the way. Not the guy I was speaking to just now, that's Jason Murphy. I mean the fellow who invented two-wheeled rolling luggage. And he worked for Northwest Airlines.
One of the big shifts we have to make is a cultural one. We have to think in a much more innovative way. We have to be prepared to do things differently tomorrow than we did yesterday, because the pace of change in the world in which we live is...
Politicians just love to talk innovation. Like fiscal responsibility and productivity, it's part of the political lexicon. But what they mean by the term is often a little blurry. In this program, we want to challenge some of the normative constructs of innovation, and we're going to start with a basic definition from Professor Mark Dodgson, the Director of the Technology and Innovation Centre at the University of Queensland. He's also a visiting professor at Imperial College Business School in London.
It's a terribly vague word. The English language really lets us down here. It's an act and a fact. It's a noun and a verb. I've heard it described as an aerosol word, which you spray in the air and everyone smells it and it smells great and lovely, but you can't grab hold of it. So I go for a simple definition, and the simple definition is new ideas successfully applied. So it's not about having ideas, it's not about discovery or creativity, but it's about putting ideas into practice, making them useful. It is very difficult to grab hold of because it's used in so many ways. It's used to describe some incredibly exciting, disruptive inventions or innovations such as the internet. And on the other hand, it's a new painted color for your bicycle or something, you know. It's used very loosely, but it's incredibly important because it really underpins your economic growth. Quality of life and standard of living is fundamentally underpinned by the way that we innovate, by the way we keep up with the rest of the world and hopefully stay a little bit ahead in some areas by successfully introducing new ideas.
So, innovation equals ideas plus implementation. Try and pay attention, class, because you will be marked on this later. And just because it's become a buzz term, doesn't mean we shouldn't value it. The challenge, says Mark Dodgson, is in making it people-focused, not technology-centric.
If we think about how long we live and the quality of our lives and the health that we have, innovation underpins all of this improvement that we've seen. We live longer and healthier lives as a result of innovation. We have opportunities to travel, unbelievable for previous generations. We have information at our fingertips that was never available to our parents or grandparents. Just think how easy it is now to access services. We don't have to go to banks or post offices and queue up to pay bills. We can do it all online. And also, innovation is removing repetitive and dangerous work. So innovation affects everybody, and it really should be on the agenda for everybody to think about and for politicians to be able to bring the innovation agenda right into the homes of everybody by thinking about what it means if we innovate and how life will improve as a result. And if we don't innovate, the consequences of that and how adverse they will be.
But for some people, innovation will be tied to fear, won't it? To the uncertainty of the future, to automation, to the potential loss of jobs, that kind of thing.
Absolutely. And there's a downside to innovation, and that has to be managed, and we have to do that very carefully. And just think about the car and the way that the automobile is changing with electric cars and the opportunity to make cars very much more safer by linking them with one another so that they don't crash and making them more safe. But I think it's over 1 million people a year, 1.3 million, in fact, people are killed in cars. And you think about the environmental damage that cars do. There's a real downside. So the electric car has got an opportunity to transform that industry. But then you think about all the people who are employed presently driving trucks and vans. It's the largest employment section in the United States. These tend to be unskilled workers. And what's going to happen to them if they lose their jobs? Well, you know, that's going to be more Trump voters, and there's going to be consequences politically in as a result of that unemployment. So technology has got many benefits, but it's also got downsides. And innovation is something that has to be very, very carefully thought about. There has to be very astute policies and very careful management to be able to deal with the downsides. The great economist Joseph Schumpeter called innovation a process of creative destruction. It creates and destroys at the same time. We have to celebrate and accentuate the creative side, and we have to be very, very careful in managing the destructive side.
I think the word innovation absolutely has become something of a buzz phrase. It seems every conference or article about technology or the economy employs the term, and usually to different ends. And I think when we at Brookings think about innovation, we're really thinking about how new ideas drive economic growth. My name is Scott Andes, and I'm a senior policy analyst and associate fellow at the Brookings Institution.
Industry on Parade. A pictorial review of events.
Now, Scott Andes says the traditional way to understand the innovation process began in the 1940s, and that formal model still holds sway today. Essentially, he says, it's a one-size-fits-all approach, and it's holding us back.
So what we're really talking about is how companies learn and create new products and services. And the way I sort of define the formal model, and this is how I would say most economists view innovation as well as policymakers, is certain institutions create scientific breakthroughs. Those can be universities, inventors, national laboratories, and then other institutions, usually companies, pay to use these technologies. The transaction is very formal. It occurs in the marketplace. In simplest terms, companies are buying technology. Suppose you have a couple of biologists at Harvard that come up with a new protein that interacts with cancer. Well, they certainly don't create cancer drugs. What they can do is patent the technology, and then if a company like Pfizer wants to make a treatment, they will pay to use that technology. It's called a license or a royalty. But the bottom line really is that innovation occurs in one place through scientific breakthroughs and then is transferred to companies through market mechanisms.
And that idea that innovation works in that way is quite... it's quite influential, isn't it, on policymakers and governments who strategize about innovation?
It absolutely is. I would go so far as to say increasingly over the last, say, 30 or 40 years in the United States and maybe last 2 to 3 decades in other countries like Australia, we see the formal model of innovation really be the predominant way that governments incentivize innovation throughout the economy.
Because it's neat, isn't it? It's easy, and it's easy to get your head around. It, you know, it's a very linear approach to the idea of innovation.
That's absolutely right. I think there's two reasons that make it super easy. One is, like, as you said, it's a linear approach. Innovation starts at one point. It's called basic science, and then it moves into a certain technology category, and then a company can step in from afar, purchase it with little to no interaction with the scientific generator, and then go to the market. So one, it's very easy to describe. Two, for governments, it's very easy to measure. So we can measure how many patents national laboratories are creating, how much licensing dollars we're getting for, say, national investments in universities. So it's really easy to sort of keep score, so to speak. Unfortunately, I don't think it's actually capturing the outputs, what we're looking for. And we're looking for new technologies that lead to economic growth, not just patents or transactions amongst companies.
So your message is that the way in which innovation actually occurs for most organizations is far messier or far less formal in the way it happens. Is that correct?
That's exactly right. I would say there's two ways that informal innovation occurs. One is it occurs through a variety of actors. This dichotomy between, you know, universities and labs as the generator of technology and then firms as the consumers really doesn't make sense in the real economy. There's a lot of research that shows that companies actually learn from each other. They learn from partnerships. They learn from suppliers that they're purchasing equipment from. And they learn from customers through feedback and other mechanisms. And this really drives a non-trivial amount of innovation in the economy. The second way that that it differs from the formal model is oftentimes market mechanisms aren't actually the most important way that knowledge is transferred. So as I said, when market mechanisms, we're talking about a company or someone purchasing technology or licensing it. Really, a lot of it occurs through informal relationships. It can happen through anything, and perhaps it's cliche, but over a beer. A lot of innovation is transferred through informal relationships. So when you see big breakthrough technologies, we'll call them radical innovation, where a new drug, like the example I was giving of Harvard biologists in a cancer treatment, that often really does happen through universities and labs. But a lot of the real important things to the market are incremental innovations. Consider a car manufacturer learning from, say, the company that makes wheels for them how to use a lighter metal. Right? It's a small incremental innovation, but it may save a lot of money, it may save energy, it may reduce manufacturing costs. These are the types of things we see through informal and incremental innovation, and often they're just as important or more important. The research indicates different types of industries focus on different parts of the sort of innovation spectrum, I would call it.
So crucially, again, if you are focused simply on that linear, that traditional, that formal idea of innovation, you're really going to miss the boat with a lot of the companies and organizations out there who want to be innovative, aren't you?
And, you know, that's exactly what I think we see in many regional economies where policies are reflected based on the linear model that just don't match the regional economy. And, you know, regional economies can be good at a variety of things. They can be good at finance or creating cars or airplanes, or they can be good at software. But because we see too much copycatting or one-size-fit-all policies, I think a lot of places are leaving a lot of innovation on the table.
Scott Handys from the Brookings Institution. And the difficulties with adopting a model of innovation that doesn't necessarily reflect the reality of your own specific circumstances. And there are dangers too, according to Mark Dodgson, in an unquestioning embrace of the myth and the ideology.
Palo Alto, the heart of Silicon Valley, is just a few miles south of San Francisco. This is the place where pirates challenge all business rules. It's the perfect habitat for big ideas aimed at changing the world. Here, everything you need.
There's a lot of important components to Silicon Valley. There's some very strong universities. There's a strong venture capital industry. There's a culture of experimentation and a culture that tolerates failure, trying again, keep on going. But I think the one thing that isn't emphasized as much as it should be is the role of the government. The government has played a crucial role in developing Silicon Valley, and it still does. through investment in defense expenditure, through investments in information and communications technology, through the government procurement schemes that buy adventurous and innovative goods and services. So I think that if we need to replicate and try to replicate the kind of conditions you get in Silicon Valley, we must bring government into that conversation. Government has a central role to play.
Now, that will surprise some people, because some people, I imagine, would look at Silicon Valley and say it's a success because government isn't involved, or it isn't apparent that government is involved.
No, that's incorrect. Government has been centrally involved and still is centrally involved in the success of Silicon Valley and America's high technology industry. If you look at products such as the iPhone, which is perceived as being an invention that came out of Apple laboratories and research, actually, if you trace back where those ideas came from, it was government-funded research. If you look at the venture capital industry in America, and particularly the most important part of it for innovation, which is early-stage innovation, the largest investor in early-stage venture capital in America is the government. The government puts twice as much money into the venture capital industry at early stage than the private sector. And then you have all the defense-related expenditure and research agencies that are doing work that feeds back in down into industry. So the government plays a crucial role in the American technology and innovation success story.
So there are lessons there for a small but ambitious country like Australia, where we don't actually spend an awful lot on innovation. And in fact, corporate research and development has been declining, hasn't it, over recent years?
Yes, depressingly it has. And so if we add up the total amount spent on R&D by our businesses in Australia, every Australian business, it amounts to about the same as what is spent by one company in Samsung or another company like Volkswagen. So one company in the rest of the world spends as much as Australian business put together. So we are small, and that means we have to be exceptionally smart. We have to be very good at deciding where we're going to spend that money and how we're going to use it. Often in this whole area of innovation and R&D, it's not a question of how much you spend, but spending it wisely, astutely. It means making decisions about which areas we're going to concentrate on. So we don't sort of spreading the money all around. We have to make some choices. Which areas are we going to support? And I think this is one of the fundamental problems. We have to improve our management skills in this area. Australian managers are not particularly adventurous. Our boards of directors are much more concerned with cost cutting and efficiencies rather than investing for the future.
You take world-class examples, be them places like Silicon Valley or Boston here in the United States, and cities around the world just carbon copy what's happening there. The real problem is, one, these cities have unprecedented assets, but they're highly good at specific types of industries, and we just assume that every type of innovation looks like a software company. So we build models. We call them incubators or accelerator programs, a number of different things that really fit software, but simply don't fit manufacturing or they may not fit, you know, retail or many other ways that we can be an extremely innovative as a society. I think there's some estimate that there's over 10,000 incubator accelerators and even more incubators now globally. I was just listening to the news where Tanzania has introduced several new accelerators as well. And while I will never criticize places for promoting technology-based economic development, the reality is the evidence suggests these things really work well in software, but have a pretty sketchy track record in a lot of other industries. So I think a way to proceed is to really think hard. Is this the right model, or are you just going to have, you know, 30, 20-something-year-olds trying to build new apps in a regional economy that just isn't made for that?
There is also, it seems to me, a sense that innovation has to be new. It has to result in completely new products. But a lot of innovation in our world is actually just the bettering of existing products, isn't it, or existing services?
That's exactly right. If you look at the industries that follow what I call the unconventional model, you see that over 80% of innovation comes from products or processes that are new to the firm, but they're not actually new to the market. So these are things that are basically allowing companies to produce better quality products for cheaper. They're not radical. They're not path-breaking types of innovations, but they're leading to economic growth. And so in that way, they're extraordinarily important.
You're listening to Future Tense with Anthony Fennell at RN Future Tense on Twitter.
Now, here's another orthodoxy to challenge. It's the idea that in order to innovate, you need to tie public research directly to corporate intention. In other words, to be of value, government-funded research needs to be directed to supporting industry. It's an approach that's popular in many countries and which Australia's major scientific organisation, the CSIRO, has largely adopted under its new chief executive, the former Silicon Valley venture capitalist Larry Marshall. But it's an approach, says leading Australian scientist Perry Bartlett, that just doesn't make sense. Bartlett is a professor of molecular neuroscience and was the inaugural director of the Queensland Brain Institute.
It does worry me when the argument can't be put across more strongly that the economics of countries, the success of countries, are built on discoveries that no one had an idea about where they were going to lead. And this is so profoundly obvious if you look at the American economy. No one knew that the maths and physics of the early 1900s would lead to the computer age, the internet, to Silicon Valley. No one knew in molecular biosciences when we discovered how DNA worked that it would lead to a revolution of biotech. And the whole of the American economy, if you look at it, has been dependent on these new discoveries to drive the increases in their economy. And yet we find the argument at the moment being much more about translation, as if discoveries weren't part of that vehicle by which you increased your translation. I would hate to see this country not be involved in the discovery of the initial intellectual property that underpinned these future economies, these future technologies, because that's where the wealth is going to be. It's not going to be in terms of us just adding a few dollars at the end. I think that's heading towards cargo cultism.
And by translation, you mean translating to business outcomes for the sort of research that we do?
Well, of course, in the biomedical field, it's translation into pharmaceuticals, therapeutics of various forms. And I think the answer is that we've been pretty good at doing translation, but again, based on fundamental discoveries, not based on just focusing directly to say we need to develop this X and Y. I mean, a very prime example of this, how directed research usually doesn't result in anything fundamentally impressive, was that Nixon spent enormous amount of money setting up cancer institutes across the US. It's maybe a bit hyperbolic, but if you look at what came out of those institutes, it was very little. It was very little. In fact, the major discovery in those times was the fact that there were genes that were involved in causing cancer, and that came from molecular bioscience. It didn't come out of these cancer institutes. So it's a very good example that if you say we're going to focus on this and bring together people who are already imbued with a certain idea about cancer, that you don't find the problem because you don't have the people in there who are going to take these risks and follow new directions.
Perry Bartlett. So let's review what we've heard. Yes, back to the blackboard. Innovation can be incremental. It doesn't always result in a shiny new invention. It can come from informal connections with customers or other organisations. It's not always going to involve startups and technology. And as Perry Bartlett just mentioned, it shouldn't be so tied down that it limits blue sky thinking. And according to our final guest today, Melbourne-based actor and writer Neil Pigott, we shouldn't get too obsessed with trying to impose innovation on everything that moves. It has no place in the art sector.
I think it's popular because there's been a steady desire on behalf of our advocates to find some economic value for something that is intrinsically of only a social value. And they've latched onto this thing called innovation. Rather than standing their ground and saying, no, hang on a second, that's antithetical to art, it answers the age-old question of how do you actually justify having something that you can't put an economic value on. And so they're running around trying to find an economic value for the arts within the innovation paradigm, if you like. And every time they kind of come up with a new way that we can be innovative, paradoxically, they're taking away a little bit of what art does to encourage innovation. What's increasingly happening in Western democracies, and particularly countries like Australia, is that we're expecting art to pay for itself, and by doing that, we're asking it to do things. We're asking it to jump through hoops. We're asking it to be innovative. We're asking it to be engaging. We're asking it to be capacity building. We're asking it to do a lot of things that all have some form of economic bottom line, because we need to be able to reduce things down to a simple formula, and art, unfortunately, doesn't work that way. You can't innovate the way people think. You can help people to think innovatively. Art is a tool for helping people to think innovatively. It in itself isn't innovative. But if you start to impose conditions on the production of art that include innovation, well, it's a term that actually just doesn't mean anything to artists. And, you know, the creative community is made up of a whole lot of people, and amongst them, particularly in my discipline, which is the theatre, you have entertainers and you have artists. Now, neither one is better than the other, but they serve different functions. One entertains people, one challenges people. One tries to make sense of the world in which we live. The other tries to distract you from it. These are two very different things, but you can't roll them all into one thing and then give them one condition of production, and that is to make something that is innovative.
You wrote an article about this recently, and in that article you made the point that there is nothing innovative about Othello. Just explain what you meant by that.
Well, there's nothing innovative about a lot of great theatre. What great theatre does, it doesn't change the world, but it, as I say, it helps us to understand the world we live in. See, theatre is the closest thing you can have to life without actually living it. So what Othello does is provide us with an example of how jealousy can manifest itself, how it can assume control of an individual, and how it can result in catastrophic circumstances. And I think, as I said in the article, you know, hopefully we're not all going to run around committing, you know, homicide or killing our wives or partners, but we can see through Othello how that takes place. And we can begin to understand the psychology of that kind of act. And then we can better understand our own actions. You know, when we do feel jealousy, we can see what the potential consequences of it are. We can see how damaging it can be, and we can pull ourselves up. I mean, that's a simple example of the function of art. And that's art doing, fulfilling its, a part of its social function. It isn't our job to make new forks.
Understanding the process of innovation and avoiding the hype. That's Future Tense for another week. Thanks to our guests, actor-writer Neil Pigott, leading Australian scientist and innovator Perry Bartlett, Scott Andes, a senior policy analyst and associate fellow with the Brookings Institution, who specialises in innovation, and finally, economist Jason Murphy. For more information, go to our website. Just search the words Future Tense and ABC or RN, and you're sure to find us. Karin Savanovitz is my co-producer, the sound engineer this week, Peter McMurray. I'm Anthony Fennell.